Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Monday, the 15th of March, 2010, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. This is episode 31 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality, and we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, Reality Check is going to become Celebrity Central as we interview not one, but three celebrities from the world of atheism and LGBT issues. First, I'll report back from the weekend's Global Atheist Convention held right here in Melbourne, and we'll hear interviews with celebrity atheists A.C. Grayling and Stuart Beckman. Then we'll have a chat with Joy's very own international celebrity, the runner-up in the worldwide Mr. Gay competition, Byron Adu. Then finally, in our movie review, we'll have a look at two new movies, Green Zone and Shutter Island. One of them is going to be Reality Check's first must-see movie of 2010. To find out which one, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Now, just before we get into this week's LGBT news roundup, I'd like to thank Sonia and Caroline for covering for me and hosting the show last week. And I'd also like to thank their special guest, Elliot Birch from the Pseudoscientists podcast, for joining them on the show. They did a fantastic job. You may be hearing more from them and from some of the other pseudoscientists in the coming weeks, but more about that later in the show. For now, let's get into our LGBT news roundup for the last couple of weeks. And what an historic couple of weeks it's been for LGBT rights, particularly marriage equality. So let's head first to Argentina. Now, if you'll recall, in the last episode of Reality Check, back on March 1st, we reported that same-sex couple Damian Bernat and Jorge Salazar Capon had just got a court order requiring the registry office in Buenos Aires to marry them. And we suggested that if they wanted to become the second same-sex couple in Latin America to be legally married, they should get a move on because Mexico City was about to open up marriage to same-sex couples within days. Well, it seems that Damian and Jorge do in fact listen to Reality Check because 2 days later on Wednesday, March 3rd, they went down to the Buenos Aires registry office and they were indeed married, becoming the second same-sex couple in the history of Latin America to do so, after the first one got married in Ushuaia, Argentina, back in December. However, unfortunately, things are not as simple as they may at first appear, because just when it seemed that everything was going swimmingly for LGBT equality in Argentina, along came a major spanner in the works, and it now seems that just like the convoluted story of the first couple to get married in Argentina dragged on for weeks, well, Damian and Jorge's story now looks like it's going to do the same thing, unfortunately. Because just 5 days after they were married, last Monday, March the 8th, a different judge in Buenos Aires declared that their marriage was null and void and ordered them to return all their marriage documents to the authorities within 72 hours, or they would be fined. At this point in time, I don't know if they've done that or not, but it looks like Damian and Jorge will almost certainly be heading back to court. And it also looks like the story of same-sex marriage in Argentina is becoming incredibly and unnecessarily complicated with lots of ups and downs along the way. And unfortunately, this week I'm going to have to leave you on a downer. But have no fear, dear listener, we will, of course, keep you informed of every development as it occurs here on Reality Check. Now, from that story of mixed good and bad news, let's turn to the two big historic stories of the last fortnight, which I'm happy to say are good news all the way. And that is that marriage equality is now a reality in both Washington, D.C. and Mexico City. Absolutely fantastic news. And I do like it how history can sometimes throw up these surprising convergences of geography and timing. Because here you have two of the largest countries in the world, next door neighbors with long, convoluted, highly interconnected histories, both of them federal countries made up of numerous states and each with one special district covering most of the urban area occupied by the capital city. Who would have thought 200 years ago, 10 years ago, even 1 year ago, that those two districts would be leading the world in LGBT equality and would end up introducing full same-sex marriage within hours of each other? What a happy coincidence of history. So, just to fill in all the details, in both the District of Columbia in the US and in the Federal District of Mexico, couples wanting to get married first have to apply for a license, and then the actual wedding ceremony will be performed a few days later. So, Washington, D.C. opened its doors to license applications on Wednesday, March 3rd, and Mexico City did it the very next day on Thursday, March 4th. In both cities, hundreds of same-sex couples received their licenses on those days. Then, finally, the first actual weddings took place last Tuesday, March 9th in Washington, D.C., and last Thursday, March 11th in Mexico City. So I'm happy to report that as we go to air right now, same-sex couples are getting married in both those cities. Finally, justice has won. And I also read that both cities are planning to hold world record-breaking mass same-sex weddings this coming weekend, apparently, so keep your eyes open for that. We really are living through historic times for LGBT rights. Now, I should mention a couple of factors that make the Mexico City law particularly interesting, and the first is that in Mexico City, same-sex couples are now allowed to adopt children as well. They could already do that in Washington, D.C., and they can now do that in Mexico City as well. And the other interesting thing about Mexico is that supposedly, according to the Mexican Constitution, all the states in Mexico, all 31 of them, are required to recognize marriages performed in Mexico City, including now same-sex marriages. So that means that, well, officially at least, same-sex couples who live outside Mexico City will be able to get married there, and that marriage must be recognized by their state of residence. Let's hope that that works smoothly in practice as well as in theory. Now, finally, just to put everything in perspective, this means that same-sex marriage now exists in 6 jurisdictions of the United States, that is 5 states plus the District of Columbia, and now exists in 10 countries. 7 of those throughout the entire country, and 3 of those, the US, Mexico, and Argentina, only in some jurisdictions. But have no doubt, dear listener, this list will continue to grow and grow, and one day it will even include Australia. Hopefully that day is not too far away. Okay, as we have a jam-packed show coming up today, I think that's all the LGBT news will have time for. Let's listen to a song now, and when we return, we're going to report back from the Global Atheist Convention held here in Melbourne over the weekend. And the worldwide Mr. Gay runner-up, Byron Adu, will report back on all the goings-on at the international competition in Oslo last month. So to find out what really went on at both events, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
Made in Melbourne for the world. Joy 94.9.
Cruising for joy? It's safe listening. Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check. I'm Tony Pittman and the station is Joy 94.9. And the song you just heard there was Lento by Mexican pop singer Julieta Venegas. And I played that song in honour of the first same-sex weddings being performed in Mexico City over these last few days. And also as a tribute to the members of the Mexico City legislature and to Mexico City's mayor, Marcelo Ebrard, who showed rare political integrity and determination to do the right thing and get this law through in face of stiff opposition. Reality Check salutes you all. We now move into the part of the show where we normally get into an in-depth analysis of a topic related to pseudoscience or the paranormal. But tonight we're going to do something a little bit different. First, we're going to hear a couple of interviews from the Global Atheist Convention that took place here in Melbourne over the weekend. Then we're going to hear the first-hand experiences of Joy 94.9's very own Byron Adu at the Worldwide Mr. Gay competition in Oslo last month. So let's go first to the Global Atheist Convention, which went from Friday night until Sunday afternoon and was an extremely thought-provoking event with an amazing list of presenters. It was also a massive event, I must say, with apparently 2,500 people attending the final day of presentations yesterday. In fact, the convention organizers claim that it was the largest gathering of atheists specifically gathered to talk about atheism ever. Some of the high-profile speakers at the event included Richard Dawkins, Peter Singer, PZ Myers, Dan Barker, Taslima Nazreen, Philip Adams, and Catherine Devaney. And, of course, Reality Check was there with microphone in hand, mingling amongst all those celebrity atheists. And we managed to grab some pearls of wisdom from 2 of the presenters, Stuart Beckman and A.C. Grayling. So, first up, let's hear what Stuart had to say. Stuart is from Los Angeles and is the president of the Atheist Alliance International. Do you think that religion is a force for harm? Would the world be better off without religion? Tough question, maybe.
You don't want to go into huge generalizations because, as was talked about today, the range of religion out there is so vast. But I think there is plenty of evidence that much of the religion out there is harmful and would be better to be exposed to the light of day, I guess I'd say.
Okay. Why are you an atheist?
I'm an atheist because I look to seek to live an ethical life based on truth and honesty and integrity, and I think anyone who takes that kind of journey to understand the world around us inevitably ends up being an atheist, as I am. I wasn't raised religious, though, so I started from that point and then followed my own path and journey to the point of realizing I really couldn't hold on to these myths anymore and had to admit I'm an atheist.
Right, so you might agree with the speaker we had today who said that it's a kind of spiritual process that they all should end up in atheism.
I think it is, yes. It's a long process, too. I don't think there's any revelation of, God's dead. You know, it takes time and lots of reflection, and I think that's a story for most ex-religious people. They kind of came to it gradually.
All right, one more question. Would anything for you prove the existence of God? Which someone asked me, and I couldn't really answer it, so I thought I'd ask you.
Now, I actually have an answer to that. Yes, if everything I have seen and learned about God and the Bible and everything, all the evil and all the malevolence and all the harm, if somehow all of that was explained to make sense as to why this was the right way to go for God's will, if that could be explained to me so I understood why all this happened, I might really consider being religious again.
Right, so in other words, the explanation that God works in mysterious ways is just not satisfactory.
No. But if God can explain to me why he's so mysterious in his ways, I'll listen to it and think about it.
All right, Stuart Beckman, thank you very much for speaking to Reality Check.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, now let's hear from A.C. Grayling. He's an eminent British philosopher at the University of London, a prolific writer, and I think, without a doubt, one of the world's most famous atheists. Now, A.C., can I ask you just first a very quick question? Why are you an atheist?
Well, because every rational reason applied to thinking about the nature of the world, what it contains, what the basis of morality is, how things work, suggests that this is a natural domain, the universe, governed by natural laws, that we human beings are part of that nature, part of animal nature. We're intelligent monkeys, and we have a duty to one another to use that intelligence responsibly. And out of the responsible use of that intelligence, we recognize that we are part of nature and part of animal nature. And there's no reason to think that there's Fred or Susan or something up there in the clouds who had anything to do with it.
Do you think that religion is actually harmful, that we would be better off without religion?
Of course, individual religious people and groups from time to time do some good. They do charitable work and they provide sense of community to one another. But if you look across the great landscape of history, alas, the religions have been very divisive, a very often source of conflict, and because of their attempt to impose orthodoxy on people, they've been very cruel sometimes and punitive. And they've also stood in the way of developments in education, in science, in the improvement of social conditions for people. I mean, even as we speak today, the opposition of a very large church in the world, the Roman Catholic Church, to contraception remains a problem. It forces people either to be hypocrites or to have families that are too large that look properly after the kids that they have. And in these ways, and that's just one example, religion can be a very negative force in our world. And I've not even mentioned their fanaticism, which is the extreme edge of religion, in the name of which people are prepared to kill other people. So on the whole, it would be vastly better if people could live open-minded, rational lives on the basis of sensible education, and also on the basis, of course, of cooperation and fellowship.
Is there anything, any form of evidence that would convince you that there is a God?
Well, if the heavens parted like a curtain's opening and a great big face with a long white beard poked out of it and said, hi, you know, I'm God, I don't know, then so long as I could rule out certain things like, you know, having a seizure or having eaten something that's caused me to hallucinate, that might begin to look like a bit of evidence. But no, really, because, earlier I said that there's no reason to think that there's a Fred or a Susan. I'm just grabbing arbitrary names out of the air, which is what God is. It's an arbitrary noise denoting our ignorance. You know, whenever we don't understand something properly or when we have to try to work out, you know, how things began or something. And since the great enterprise of science is yet full of many, many questions and many gaps, what some people do is they say, well, then there has to be some kind of spiritual agency out there that did it all. And that's an entirely arbitrary and unevidenced move. And it would be very difficult indeed to see how the massively accumulated data and insight and understanding provided by science could be controverted by some ancient religion.
All right, final question. It's to do with the issue, actually, the issue that Peter Singer was talking about this morning of can you be moral without God? My question is slightly different. It is maybe why should we be moral? For example, if you're arguing with someone who were in a position of absolute power, say a Roman emperor or someone, so there were no consequences, bad consequences of being immoral, and he or she could actually benefit by exploiting and using people, and maybe he or she didn't have a kind of a natural ick reaction to hurting people, how would you argue that he or she should be moral?
It is, of course, true that human beings are a mixed alloy, in the sense that we are capable both of bad and good, and we can sometimes be very selfish. And when people are given unbridled power, as has happened with dictators and Roman emperors, and if they have a propensity to bad, then that can be amplified by the fact that they are unconstrained. But the general answer is this: human beings are social animals, profoundly social, and we need one another, and our relationships with other people are tremendously important to us. What we are, our very identity and well-being, depends upon our having good relationships with other people. We depend on our community life. And therefore, things like cooperation and concern for others, our instinctive kindness that makes us call out to somebody who's just about to fall into a hole or onto whose heads the bricks are about to fall, shows that we have an instinctive connections with one another, even though we also have this propensity, which is largely culturally driven, I think, to think of some others as members of an out-group. So we're kinder to people of the in-group, and then we're hostile to people of the out-group. But that is something which is historically, culturally, and very often religiously based. But as animals, we are social. We need these connections. And when we reflect on them, because we have the capacity for mature reflection, what we do is we recognize that these relationships involve obligations and needs. They explain to us why sometimes we have great affection for other people, tenderness. We need intimacy. If our friends are important to us. And out of all these connections comes the rich foliage of morality on which the philosophers have pondered for over 2,500 years, indeed for much, much longer than Christianity has been around.
All right, A.C. Grayling, thank you very much for giving us a few minutes of your time on Reality Check.
Great pleasure. Thank you.
So there you have it, dear listener, the words straight from the mouths of two international celebrity atheists, sharing their wisdom, especially with you, here on Reality Check. Now, from the sublime to the, well, possibly less sublime, let's change the topic completely now on Reality Check. But still continuing with our celebrity theme, let's talk now to Joy's very own international celebrity, Byron Adu. I don't know if Byron's an atheist, but he's certainly had an interesting experience in the last few weeks. Byron presents Glitter and Tonic along with Steve at 9 o'clock on Thursday nights here on Joy 94.9. And not only is he Mr. Gay Australia, but just 4 weeks ago, he was also crowned the runner-up of the worldwide Mr. Gay competition held in Oslo, Norway. So, a couple of days ago, I caught up with Byron here in the Joy 94.9 studios to have a chat with him about his experiences on the international gay pageant circuit. Joining me in the studio now is a man fresh off the plane from the worldwide Mr. Gay competition in Oslo, Norway, where he came first runner-up, making him officially the second most all-round amazing gay man in the known universe. So a huge congratulations and welcome to Reality Check, Byron Adu.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you so much for that kind introduction. How are you today?
today?
Very well, thank you, Byron. And how are you?
Yeah, going very well, thank you. I'm still recovering from being back to reality, I guess. I wish I was overseas, still in the competition or in Norway, and I went to London as well for a few days. So it'll be nice to still be on holidays.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Still coming down from the buzz, I guess.
Yeah.
So, Byron, I want to ask you about your experiences in Norway and with this competition. But before I get into that, I just want to mention to the listener that the situation is a little bit complicated because you are not only the runner-up of what's called the Worldwide Mr. Gay Competition, but last year you were also runner-up of a separate competition called the International Mr. Gay Competition.
Yes, that's right.
So double congratulations.
Thank
to you.
Commiserations. I'm always the bridesmaid, never the bride.
Oh, no, congratulations. Runner-up is fantastic in our books.
Thank you.
So, well, actually, can you just tell us a bit about the process that you went through, the order, like you first won in Australia and then what happened?
Firstly, just so the listeners don't think I'm a beauty pageant addict, I didn't just go to both of those pageants hoping to win. The process was I competed in the Australian leg and was fortunate enough to become Mr. Gay Australia. And the prize for that was to go and compete in the Mr. Gay International competition in the Philippines last year. Unfortunately, that was postponed and then eventually cancelled. They blamed the GFC and then swine flu, which was going around at the time.
Right.
So
hang on. So the Mr. Gay Australia, this was like early 2009?
That was late 2008.
Oh,
so we're
okay.
Going back, you know, almost a couple of years now, about
okay.
18 months. So
all
it was
right.
November 2008, I think, mm-hmm. that happened. And so I was meant to be going to San Francisco initially in Mr. Gay International competition, and I got relocated to the Philippines in mid-2009.
Right.
And unfortunately, that didn't go ahead. So to try and decide the winner for that, they actually held an online poll worldwide. And I was fortunate enough to come second in that. So
fantastic.
I was happy with that. And
yeah.
That was it. Like, I'd never entered the competition wanting to win anything. I went there initially to watch a friend of mine compete, and a judge approached me to participate, and it all kind of snowballed from there. So
wow.
After I came second in the online poll, I was fine, you know, happy and got on with my life. And then the president of the Mr. Gay World competition, it was formerly called Worldwide Mr. Gay, but they've changed the name back again to Mr. Gay World.
Oh, I read that. Yeah, just to add to the confusion. So
yes,
not only was there the International Mr. Gay, then there was the Worldwide Mr. Gay, which started as Mr. Gay World
yes.
and changed back to Mr. Gay World. Oh,
very
right.
thoroughly researched on it.
Exactly. Well,
so they've recently changed the name back to Mr. Gay World.
All
so
right.
The president of that Mr. Gay World competition approached me and asked if I wanted to compete in the Mr. Gay World competition, which was held last month in February in Oslo in Norway. So got over there, competed from the 10th to the competition finished on the 14th of
mm-hmm,
February.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an amazing experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, incredible. I loved it.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you about that. What was the feeling like? What was the ambience? What were your interactions with the other contestants and things like that?
Well, I came over there and some of my friends were thinking the same, that the contestants were going to be quite narcissistic or bitchy and, you know, trying to pull out each other's hair out. I didn't have hair, so it wasn't going to be a problem for me. But you know,
not for me, yeah.
You know, doing nasty things to each other and having a few egos and you know, bumping of heads there.
But right.
It was absolutely incredible. Everybody was so supportive of each other. We got along so well. It was like we were in the Big Brother house for 4 or 5 days, because we each had a roommate and we're with each other from, you know, when we woke up until we went to bed.
Mm.
That was basically, you know, our experiences together, and we did everything together. So it was incredible. And everybody was so supportive of each other, both leading up to the finale night and during the finale as well. And incredible. I loved it. I wish I could do it again.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Those experiences where you get to be in that environment of a whole lot of international delegates or competitors, like, they don't come very often in a normal lifetime.
No.
So they're things to really treasure.
I loved it even more because I hadn't seen snow since I was a kid. So when I got to Oslo, there was just snow everywhere, and it snowed the first day I was there quite heavily.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
I was loving it.
Of course.
-1.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's exotic for us. Yeah,
yeah, it is. Yeah. Something different.
Yeah, exactly.
Quite enjoyable.
Oslo in February. Cool. And so what were the different segments or whatever you call them? I presume there was like the swimwear section, and what else was there?
Yeah, we had all of that because the competition finale was split over Friday and a Saturday night.
Right.
But, the competition ran from Wednesday until technically Sunday morning, but the winner was announced on Saturday night. So leading up to the actual finale night on Friday and Saturday, we met with the mayor of Oslo and had a tour around the city hall. We also met with politicians at their parliament there, this national parliament, and had a tour around that. We're lucky enough to go down to the Nobel Peace Prize Center and had a tour there as well. Part of the competition, we had to have an interview with the judges where we spoke about ourselves and we were asked, you know, numerous questions.
Right.
Trying, I guess, gauge how we'd respond under pressure to various things.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also had to talk about ourselves. There was a section called My Gay Story where we only had 30 seconds, basically, to talk about our lives or our country or being gay in our country, any of that. I was lucky enough to actually win the prize for that. So that was a pleasant surprise.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that was cool. And then there was other just kind of fun, sporty stuff, which was we played against one of the national handball teams over there and also went ice skating, which I hadn't done since I was a kid as well. So cool. I did one lap and then I kind of embarrassedly scooted off to the side. Yeah, that was, and we had a couple of photo shoots as well. One was in a shop window and around a shop, so we're just in our underwear or our swimwear, posing and doing crazy things. And the photographer had to give us feedback at the end, and with me, he just kind of looked at me and said, "I think you should spend the weekend looking through fashion magazines to get an idea of how you're supposed to pose." But I said, "You know, if I decide to be a model, I'll do that. But thank you."
That's right. Exactly. I can pose how I want to.
Yeah, that's right. You know. And then we had another photo shoot as well, which was just in a cafe kind of setting, but we were using tables and backgrounds and all that kind of stuff. So it was great.
So it wasn't just a competition. It was a lot of activities that you were all involved with.
Yeah, that's right. So they during the activities, they'd be watching how we interacted with each other and what we did and how we, I guess, how we carried ourselves as people. And there's also a category of Mr. Congeniality, so coming down to how our peers viewed us as well. So
right. Oh,
taking
okay.
all these things into consideration leading up to the swimwear and the underwear section and all that on the finale night.
Right, so all these events, you were being observed
The judges
by
were
the
with
judges.
Us constantly.
Oh, I see. So that was all actually part of the competition.
That's
how
right.
How you interacted and how you acted. And
but it was interesting because they didn't tell us that. We knew we were being judged on certain things with the interview and the gay story, but when we went to the sporting events, for example, we weren't aware we were being judged.
And your ice skating was being judged.
No, that's right. And even though I did one lap, myself and Mr. Poland won the Mr. Gay Sport Award. So it must have been in handball because I was the first one to get a goal. So maybe that's what got me over the line.
Must have been it.
I think it took the pressure off, though, not knowing that we were being judged all the time.
So. Yeah. Well, you'd be much more relaxed, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Now, I did want to ask you about the Mr. Gay China contestant because that certainly, I think, his participation this year did create a lot of international publicity in the mainstream media. It got a coverage in the New York Times and a lot of other papers because the competition was cancelled at the last minute in Beijing in January, and then they had a clandestine vote and he was selected and went off kind of secretly to Oslo. Now, what did you get to interact with him, and what were his feelings like, and was he preoccupied about having to go back to China and deal with the consequences?
He was a great guy. He couldn't speak much, well, he couldn't really speak any English. And he had a translator with him, but that was only when he was doing interviews, which was basically the entire time because the media were just around him all the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the constant pressures, I guess, of doing that. We all admired him, all the contestants admired him, I guess, the example that he was showing to other gay Chinese men and women as well around the world where they're in that kind of situation. He didn't express to us concern about going back. He did talk about how it was difficult for him to come over. And he ended up coming fourth in the competition. Yeah, he was a great contestant, and we got along quite well. There was one night, because with the competition, there's a national costume section, and he didn't realize that he had to bring over a national costume.
Oh, right.
So he was getting a bit worried. I was trying to explain to him the national costume, and he didn't understand. So we had to go to his computer in his room, and he'd write it in Chinese, what his questions were, and then I have to write it in English, then he'd use his translator to translate it again.
Right.
We did that for about 10 minutes, and then eventually we went and got a translator, but it was all okay.
And he came up with something for the evening.
That's right.
He came up with a costume.
He did, and he looked great. He looks great.
Oh, cool. All right, Byron. Now, just a quick question for you personally. I guess it's probably difficult for a lot of people to place you, like, ethnically, your background.
Yeah.
Now, what is your ethnic background?
My dad is from Ghana, which is in a western part of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And my mum is from Australia. She's white appearance, white background.
Right,
and they met in London when my mum was living over there and my dad was living over there too. So met there, came back to Australia, and I was born in little old Adelaide.
Okay.
Back in the 80s. I lived in Sydney for a while, moved back to Adelaide, and now I'm in Melbourne.
Cool. That's great. I mean, there are not that many Africans in Australia, particularly West Africans, particularly Ghanaians.
Yeah.
So I guess I bet a lot of people never guess your origins, probably, suspecting.
A couple of the guys, when I was over there, they initially thought that I was Indigenous Australian. But
oh, right. Uh-huh.
I think they just assume that, being Australian and have darker skin complexion.
Right.
Straightened it out for them.
Okay. And have you been to Ghana?
No, the plan is to do a big kind of family holiday there this year with my partner, Craig, and my mum and my sister later in the year to go back and see it all, which would be great.
Yeah, fantastic.
Haven't been before. My dad still lives in Adelaide and my parents aren't together anymore, but we know a bit about where he's from and where he lived, and he's got some family there, so it'd be great to go over and see them.
Oh, absolutely. Fantastic. Well, have a great trip when you go.
Thank you. Hopefully I get to go this year.
Yeah, sounds very exciting. Okay, well, Byron Adu, who is a 24-year-old investigation officer for a federal government agency by day and the second most amazing gay man in the universe by night.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much for joining us on Reality Check.
Thanks so much, Tony. Been a pleasure.
So there you have it, dear listener. Fortunately, international fame and celebrity hasn't gone to Byron's head, and as you can hear, he remains a very down-to-earth and friendly guy. Now, finally, before we get into our last song, if you have any questions or comments about what we've covered on the show, or maybe something you'd like us to cover, please feel free to send an email. The address is realitychecktony, that's T-O-N-Y, @gmail.com. And you can also visit our webpage, that's realitycheckonline.net. Okay, let's listen to our final song for today, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie review.
All day, all night. Joy 94.9.
It's our pleasure to bring you Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. The song you just heard there was El Baile y el Salón by Mexican pop group Café Tacuba. And that goes out to all our listeners, particularly in Mexico City, who are celebrating the arrival of marriage equality in their great city, particularly to Horacio, David, and Hector, and especially to Reality Check's other half, Isidro. Besos a ti, mon amor. Mwah. Okay, it's movie review time here on Reality Check, and the two movies up for review this week are both new releases with a lot of tough guys and testosterone, Green Zone and Shutter Island. Let's start with Green Zone. This is the latest collaboration between British film director Paul Greengrass and Hollywood superstar Matt Damon. They previously worked together on two of the Bourne movies, The Bourne Supremacy and The Bourne Ultimatum. And this time they're back with an action thriller set in Baghdad in the days immediately following the US invasion of Iraq in 2003. Matt Damon plays Roy Miller, a US Army officer in charge of a squad tasked with finding where Saddam has hidden all his weapons of mass destruction. They keep receiving intelligence telling them to go and search various locations around Baghdad, but they never seem to find anything. Soon, Roy starts to question the reliability of the intelligence they're receiving and, with the help of the Baghdad CIA bureau chief, goes off base to try to find out what's really going on. Now, one thing Paul Greengrass does well is the handheld camera action sequences. In fact, through the two Bourne films he's made, he's been largely credited with redefining the way Hollywood action movies are now made. They're pretty much all done nowadays with handheld camera thrown straight into the action, as if we were watching the footage of a news photographer trying to capture everything going on around them. And he uses that style pretty effectively once again in Green Zone. But I have to say, even though the camera work is pretty effective, in my opinion, Green Zone is a pretty disappointing and flawed movie. The scriptwriters have tried to work the plot around what really happened in the days and weeks following the US invasion of Iraq. And unlike The Hurt Locker, for example, which avoided any discussion of the wider politics of the Iraq conflict, this movie is almost all about the politics and is a damning indictment of the Bush administration and the way it handled both the invasion of Iraq and the subsequent occupation, which in itself is all well and good, and I'm all for anything that remorselessly criticizes the Bush administration for its idiocy. But they try to deal with these issues in the context of a kind of formulaic shoot-'em-up car chase action thriller with cliched dialogue and two-dimensional characters, and it just doesn't work. It comes across as patronizing and preachy, like trying to use a dumbed-down story to get across a heavy-handed political message. It's a little bit cringeworthy at times, actually. And I think the other main problem is that because it's all based on what really did happen following the US invasion, well, half of the tension is taken out of the thriller elements of the film because, well, guess what? We know what's going to happen because we know what really happened. So, for example, in the first scene when they're looking for weapons of mass destruction, it's like, gosh, do you think they're going to find some? Oh, no, they didn't. What a surprise. And then they meet the Wall Street Journal reporter who's been writing a whole series of articles supporting the invasion of Iraq based on intelligence reports that Saddam has weapons of mass destruction. And it turns out that those intelligence reports were, gosh, I don't believe it, false. Who would have thought? And I have to say that the scene where Matt Damon confronts the guilty-looking journalist about her articles is really just embarrassing to watch. Gosh, you mean I was misled by my own government to make the case for war? Oh, I feel so terrible now. We in the media will learn now from this terrible mistake. Well, I wouldn't worry too much, dear, because Matt Damon will sort it all out. Except, of course, we know that he won't because we know that he didn't. No one has managed to sort out the mess in Iraq, even until today. So then it gets even sillier when Matt Damon goes off to try to save the life of an evil Iraqi general who was one of Saddam's henchmen. Now, why does he want to do this? Well, for various contrived reasons, but mainly because if the US administration can work with the former Iraqi army officers and former Ba'ath Party officials, it can hold the country together more easily and make the transition smoother. But there are two big problems with this. Number one is that we know that this can't happen in the movie because this is not what happened in real life. In real life, the US administration dismantled the Iraqi army and dismissed everyone with former links to the Ba'ath Party. A stupid decision that created so much unnecessary chaos and havoc. And the second problem is that the stakes are not very clear. You keep asking yourself, Hang on, why is Matt Damon running around again getting shot at and trying to save the life of this murderous Iraqi general? Oh, yeah, something about negotiating for a future Iraqi government which no one really wants and is not going to happen anyway. Yeah. The one thing this movie does do effectively is that for people who already think that the fact that George W. Bush was elected most powerful man in the world, not once, but twice, was one of the greatest tragedies of human civilization, this movie just works you up into a frenzied, frothing lather of impotent fury by reminding you just how stupid and arrogant and incompetent and positively harmful that administration was. But it gives you no outlet for that frustration. And I have to say that I actually left Green Zone feeling pretty depressed. Not only because the movie is pretty silly, but because I got all angry and worked up about Bush's foreign policy all over again, and with no payoff. Matt Damon can't win, and Bush will just end up serving 8 full years in the White House and then retiring peacefully to his ranch in Texas. There will be no justice either in the movie or in the real world. But I'm pleased to say that my disappointment at Green Zone was made up for when I went to see our second movie up for review tonight, Shutter Island. And as you will recall at the start of tonight's show, I mentioned that one of the films up for review this evening was going to be Reality Check's first must-see movie recommendation of 2010. Well, this is it, the latest offering from legendary Hollywood film director Martin Scorsese, Shutter Island. I loved this movie. Now, I don't want to give too much away about the plot, because the less you know, the better. But if you liked movies such as Memento, or The Machinist, or Identity, or the Spanish film Open Your Eyes, remade as Vanilla Sky, or even something like Fight Club or Donnie Darko, then you'll probably enjoy Shutter Island as much as I did. What I'm saying is that if you like those kind of movies where you don't really know what's going on and nothing is what it seems and they keep you guessing until the very last shot, then definitely go and see Shutter Island. It's 2 hours of pure escapist fun. Shutter Island is set in 1954 and tells the story of U.S. Marshal Teddy Daniels, played by Leonardo DiCaprio, and his new partner Chuck, played by Mark Ruffalo, who have been sent to an asylum for the criminally insane to investigate the supposed escape of a deranged and dangerous murderess. The asylum is located on the bleak and foreboding Shutter Island, surrounded on all sides by sheer rock cliffs and freezing ocean. The two marshals begin their investigation, and it soon becomes clear that there is more going on this sinister island than meets the eye. Now, I've read some reviews of this movie that criticize it for the heavy, dramatic music and the overwrought, almost hysterical tone all the way through. But I couldn't disagree more. If anything, I would say to Martin Scorsese, you were too light in your stylistic touches. Turn everything up even more. Give us more of that heavy, dramatic music. Ramp up even more the sense of ominous, impending danger and the unsettling feeling that terrible, unspeakable crimes are being committed on Shutter Island. I mean, this is classic B-movie fare. We're in a lunatic asylum for the criminally insane, for crying out loud. This is not supposed to be social realism. This is pure escapist fun. Let's ramp everything up a notch and make it even more fun, I say. But actually, I don't want to say too much more about Shutter Island. Just go along and enjoy the ride. This is silly, this is way over the top, but it's also utterly engrossing and keeps you gripped until the very last shot. A must-see movie, in my opinion. Now, just before we conclude today's show, I just wanted to let you know that I'm going to be away from Reality Check for the next 3 weeks. I'll be back on April 12th, but steering the show in my absence will be the very capable Caroline once again, with Sonia helping her out for 1 or 2 episodes, and this time they'll be joined each week by another special guest from the Pseudoscientists podcast, celebrity skeptic Jason Ball. And there may even be some other surprise celebrity guests along the way. So to hear their skeptical take on life, the universe, and everything, tune in to Reality Check for the next 3 Mondays at 8 o'clock. And that brings us to the end of the 31st episode of Reality Check on Joy 94.9. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com and visit our website at realitycheckonline.net. And remember to tune in at 8 o'clock for the next 3 Mondays for those special episodes presented by Kaz, Sonia, and Jason. Okay, have a great week, everyone, and I'll see you on April 12th.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.